Hello and welcome to Israel Policy Pod. I'm your host, Shani Reichman, interviewing your usual host, Neri Zilber. Hi, Neri.
Hi, Shani. The tables have turned.
Yes, it's very exciting. For everyone's information, Neri and I are actually recording together in New York for the first time ever.
That's right. New York City, live and direct. And we're doing, I guess, a pre-planned but emergency podcast about the situation in Israel.
Yeah, it's been a very chaotic week. Maybe one of those weeks that feels like it's smushed an entire year of events into it. Our listeners all already know that there's been a mad dash to get in all the judicial legislation before Passover, with protests getting larger and more frequent. And just 1 hour ago, and we're recording at 2 p.m. Eastern on Monday, March 27th, Benjamin Netanyahu announced that he will pause the legislation. So what exactly did he say, Neri? And tell us if this is a real win for the protesters and the opposition to the reform, or is it another political maneuver from our mastermind Bibi?
Well, I'd take issue with characterizing late-stage Bibi Netanyahu as a political mastermind. We can get into it in a second, but he's made unimaginable, historic, sometimes really stupid political mistakes over the past 3 or 4 months. But I'll tackle the second part first. Whether it was a huge victory or a maneuver by Bibi, both. But really, up until, say, a day or two ago, Netanyahu and his coalition partners were adamant that they weren't going to back down, that they were going to push through at least the first bill of their judicial overhaul, basically trying to take control over the committee that appoints judges in Israel. So they wanted to pass a law by Passover, by Pesach next week. And they were adamant they weren't going to back down from that. And lo and behold, Netanyahu just gave a speech, like you said, about an hour and a half ago, saying that he was in fact suspending that legislation. So on the one hand, I think unequivocal, major, and quite important victory for the anti-government protest movement. Truly forcing the government, forcing Netanyahu to back down. And we also have to remember where the government was in early January when they announced this massive and highly ambitious and highly dangerous judicial overhaul plan. It had multiple components to it. They were going to do it all by Passover. That's what they promised. And they also said this was only going to be the first stage of multiple stages of their overhaul plan. And so they whittled it down and whittled it down until they got to this one or two laws that they wanted to pass before Passover. And even that now has been suspended. So a truly important victory due to really the blood, sweat, and tears of hundreds of thousands of Israelis. Israeli patriots that have taken to the streets for 3 straight months, forcing the government's hand. And on the flip side, it was a political maneuver by Bibi because he didn't say he was backing down completely from his judicial, what he calls his judicial reform plans, quote unquote reform plans, but that he was suspending it for a month or so till the Knesset summer session. So basically going through the Passover break and then the other Independence Day and Memorial Day holidays. And he at least intends to pick it back up in the summer session. And of course, according to Bibi, he's going to give a chance to for sincere dialogue, outstretched hand, all that nicer rhetoric that was very much missing in recent weeks. So yes, it buys Netanyahu some time. The government will take a step back, regroup, reassess. That's fine. But really, the one demand by the protesters and the opposition was that the government halt. Just stop. Stop with the legislation and enter into sincere negotiation. And at least outwardly, that's what Netanyahu offered today, finally.
So does this mean that we are going to see a pause to the protest movement as well? Who is even in control of that?
So that's a great question. I think the latest as of a few minutes ago was that the protest movement, and by the way, this protest movement is really a bottom-up grassroots movement. Dozens of disparate groups, high-tech workers, IDF reservists, doctors, lawyers, high school kids, university students. I mean, it's endless number of groups really that organically sprung up to defend Israeli democracy. And so It's a question of whether they're all united in their kind of common purpose moving forward, especially given today's events. But I think the indication was that a few minutes ago that they would still stay on the streets until Netanyahu removed the entire judicial overhaul from the agenda. So you might still see protests in the coming weeks, but I think likely on a smaller flame than what we've seen now in the past month or two. That you keep the protests going, but it would just attract a few less people. And I think that's reasonable. That's natural. Israelis have been essentially putting almost everything on hold for the past few months, taking time off work, taking vacation days, working full time, and then protesting full time. And so I think a semblance of sanity, especially over the holiday period, is likely called for, just a breather for the Israeli public. But yeah, you might still see protests. And then obviously it all delays things to the summer. And the genesis of the protest movement was as a reaction to the government. So we have to wait and see what the government actually decides to do and how it decides to play this moving forward.
Well, we know that, of course, the protests on a massive scale have seriously impacted this, and they've been going on for a very long time. But a lot has happened just in the past 48 hours that seems to have changed things and really, really put a ton of pressure on Netanyahu and his coalition to pause it. So talk to us a little bit about what the last weekend meant in terms of the defense minister. You have Gallant speaking out against the overhaul, getting fired, massive 3 a.m. protests across Tel Aviv, seeing the labor unions get involved, flights stopping to leave Israel. So what did that look like? And is there, can you name any one thing that you believe really tipped the scale? Or is it hard to pinpoint given that so many groups kind of came together, which culminated in this massive, massively impactful protest?
So I think unarguably Gallant's actions and then the firing of Gallant, and we have to remember he's a Likud member, Netanyahu's handpicked defense minister, really was a tipping point. Whereas even just last week, Netanyahu gave a speech, again, a primetime address to the nation, and said he wasn't backing down. And today he gave a primetime speech to the nation and said he was backing down, at least temporarily. So undoubtedly it was Gallant's decision to break with Netanyahu and break with the government and the coalition and give his own speech Saturday night, right? It was Saturday night, and essentially indicating that the judicial overhaul and the unrest in the nation and then spreading unrest inside the IDF was a clear and present danger to Israel's national security. Clear and present danger, no more, no less. He couldn't have been any clearer. And also said that, in especially given this very delicate geopolitical and strategic moment for Israel with Iran and Hezbollah and the Palestinian arena, that this was very dangerous for the country. So Gallant actually went up and gave his own speech Saturday night. And Netanyahu's response Sunday was not to listen to his own defense minister, not to listen to his own security chiefs. It was to summarily sack Yoav Gallant. And that was Sunday, yesterday. And then almost immediately you had people in Tel Aviv and really all over Israel, from Beersheba and a lot in the south to Carmel in the north to Jerusalem and definitely in Tel Aviv, the dramatic image we saw on the Ayalon Highway, just pouring out spontaneously onto the streets. It wasn't planned. There's no guiding hand from above, no matter what the Israeli right or certain American right-wingers might have us believe. There's no guiding hand. It's just spontaneous word of mouth. Everybody literally getting messages. Everybody come to Kaplan Street in Tel Aviv next to the Ayalon. And people did, I think at midnight, right? And they were there for several hours. I think the highway was closed for about 5 hours in Tel Aviv. So that was really dramatic, but that also had the added consequence, right? Gallant's firing and then the mass protests Sunday evening and night and into the morning, of getting the labor union involved, the Histadrut. This is the large, historic Israeli trade union federation. Basically used to run the country. Not anymore, but it has hundreds of thousands of a lot of public sector workers and other unions all over the country. And the Histadrut, from the very beginning of the protest movement, refrained from getting involved. It was on the sidelines. Despite major entreaties and pleads pleas really from the opposition and the protest movement to get involved, and they refused. They refused to get involved in what was deemed a political domestic matter. They said Drut goes on general strike for economic reasons, right? Demanding better pay. And so that's in and of itself a general strike by the Histadrut, nothing out of the ordinary in Israel. But last night, the head of the Histadrut actually went down and joined the protesters in his hometown. And they declared this morning that they were joining the protest and calling their own general strike. And so essentially the country on Monday was completely paralyzed. The country was put on a complete halt. And so even Bibi Netanyahu and even the more extreme elements in the coalition had to wake up and had to respond. And this is the pressure that was put on Bibi. And he finally relented.
It's interesting to note that this is very unique because from an American standpoint, it feels as though Israelis are on strike about three times a month. And that there's nothing they love more than a good strike. But I appreciate you naming that this is actually very different from usual.
Yeah, not necessarily a strike, but Israelis do protest a lot. And so protests on the streets in and of themselves aren't that out of the ordinary. And protests against Netanyahu governments also not that out of the ordinary. But the breadth and the longevity and the scale of these protests are nothing like Israel has ever seen before. Three straight months of mass demonstrations all over the country with hundreds of thousands of people. So that in and of itself, Netanyahu seemed to think he could weather that storm. But then really the economic damage of the union striking and really the entire, by the way, it's not just the unions, it's essentially the entire private sector and business community who also really joined in a big way on Monday. Can't ignore that, despite Netanyahu's best efforts to ignore everybody else, including his own security chiefs.
Yeah. And just to take us back a minute to the defense minister piece, immediately after Gallant was fired, there were reports of Avi Dichter, another member of the coalition, who was threatening to potentially be against the overhaul, being given that position as maybe what some might call a bribe to vote with the Likud. So did that happen? And if so, has that been overturned sort of because of the pause in legislation? What's going on there?
So as of this recording, I don't think Gallant has been unfired, despite some speculation that Bibi may even have been pressed to take that step. So I don't believe Gallant will return as defense minister, although you never know. And yes, if Gallant isn't defense minister, then someone else has to be defense minister. Avi Dichter, also a Likud official, currently a more junior minister, but a former head of the Shin Bet internal security agency, would likely be the natural choice. Look, we shouldn't mince any words here. The fact that Netanyahu fired his own defense minister from the Likud party, no less, from his own Likud party, 3 months into a new administration. Nothing like that has ever happened before in Israeli history, and in and of itself will have major strategic and military ramifications because Gallant, aside from being a former senior general himself and very knowledgeable in terms of just the functioning of the army, he was working as a defense minister, getting a staff in order, meeting with U.S. officials and other international officials, all of that, to change horses midstream like this, especially, like I said, at a very sensitive geopolitical moment, that alone is a sort of madness. And so in terms of Netanyahu's decision making, a terrible move politically, a terrible move strategically, yes. I don't know. I don't know any other way to put it. That alone would have been enough to perhaps get people out on the streets, and it was definitely a catalyzing effect. I think people who themselves had been on the sidelines for the better part of the protest movement finally said, "Okay, this in and of itself is crazy. Firing your own defense minister for essentially doing his job and getting up and warning the country and the government about the looming dangers is not befitting a reasonable and responsible leader."
Great.
I think there's no kind of nuance to this or two sides to it. Yes, that's where Israel was at. But again, if we take a step back and look at where Israel was even a day ago, to say nothing of a few days ago, in terms of the government's intention to ram these bills through parliament and then likely create a constitutional crisis and a standoff between the Supreme Court and the government, and the fracturing even of the IDF and the Shin Bet and other security agencies. I mean, it could have gotten very bad very quickly. And so now at least it's kind of a step back from the brink for everybody involved, but especially the country.
Mm-hmm. And where is the other side? Because right-wing protests are also very common in Israel. And I mean, what is now, I guess, the second largest protests were around the Haredi draft law, right? So where are the right-wing protesters right now? I know there were calls for a counter-protest. I know there have been, at different points, a few different counter-protests, but they seem to not be scaling that up. So I'm curious what you've been seeing there.
So you're right. They finally, in a real way, got government supporters, Israeli right-wingers out on the streets today, Monday evening in Jerusalem. This kind of snap call to take to the streets of Jerusalem to counter-protest and to defend the government and defend the judicial reform agenda. And from what I was told by friends on the ground in Jerusalem, it was actually a very significant and large showing by the Israeli right. At least, I think, tens of thousands of people. But that is an outlier, or that has been an outlier. Up until, I guess, today, Netanyahu had pressed on that button several times in the past, say, couple of years, whether due to him being indicted in the start of his trial, whether due to him being toppled and protests against the Ben Lapid government. And these protests, I went to many of them. There weren't that many people showing up. Actually pathetic in terms of the attendance, given the scale or the stakes involved, right? And so I guess finally they got people out of the streets. There were a number of settler rabbis who called on their followers to head to Jerusalem. A lot of kind of right-wing ultra-nationalist groups also mobilized. So, a lot of people in Israel do support those streams and those elements and this government. And I think kudos should be sent the way of the Israel police, because as of this recording, I don't think there have been any real reports of violence between the two camps on the streets.
Speaking of police, one of the ways in which Netanyahu seems to have been able to maintain his coalition while pausing the overhaul was a nice gift to Itamar Ben-Gvir, which I've seen referred to as his own civilian National Guard, which to me sounds a lot like a militia. Is that true? Is that a rumor? Is it really happening? What does that mean? Because as we've covered on this show, Ben-Gvir has been a little bit disappointed that he has not been able to treat the police like his own militia, because he has wanted them to be cracking down a lot more on these protesters. And frankly, I think we've seen them do a pretty positive job of making sure there isn't significant violence. So what does he want, and what is being given to him?
So it was given to him. There was an agreement between Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir. Essentially, you talked about bribes earlier, but to get Ben-Gvir's consent to the suspension of the judicial legislation, this was, I guess, one of the demands made by Ben-Gvir to really create and have approved this this National Guard. They're supposed to approve it, I think, in the cabinet meeting Sunday. So next Sunday before Passover. And so there has been a lot of hand-wringing and hysteria, especially online, about this development. And it is concerning. So I don't want to kind of minimize it. But it's important to keep a few things in mind. Number one, there had already been an attempt to create an Israeli National Guard, and it was officially formed last year under the Bennett government. And this was meant to be this kind of mobilization force, a reserve force, to mobilize in case of internal domestic troubles like the riots of May 2021, to essentially help out the Israel police and the riot police and the border police. And so you'd have essentially reserve volunteers as part of this National Guard, not dissimilar to the American model. Now, Ben-Gvir, in the coalition agreement he signed with Netanyahu back in December, this was part of it. the establishment of a National Guard was part of it. So you could view it as Netanyahu essentially more fully committing to that promise. I would say with the caveat that you know, Netanyahu is not not usually a man of his word, to put it mildly. So we have to wait and see whether they actually follow through on that. And then what does follow through actually look like? Israel is many things, but government bureaucracy is not that nimble in Israel. Recruiting individuals, not that easy. I think that was the main issue behind the slow moving of Bennett's National Guard agenda. So who are going to be recruited and what that process will look like, budgets, resources, and the like, and also how this National Guard would really operate within the confines or not of the Israel police and the border police. So essentially, it might be under the purview of Itamar Ben-Gvir, but is he really going to be able to give orders to this force, and what would that actually look like? Is it still beholden to the cabinet? Is it beholden to the police commissioner, and so on and so forth? So basically, the fact that they approve it on paper next week doesn't mean that you will have a fully fledged and formed Ben-Gvir militia running around Israel in May suppressing protesters, like Ben-Gvir very much wanted the police to do, and which the police, to their utmost credit, basically ignored Ben-Gvir. So we have to wait and see. It's, again, not to minimize it, it is concerning, especially that Netanyahu gave any and all of this to a person like Itamar Ben-Gvir to begin with. But that's, again, has to do more with Netanyahu's own decision making in these last few months.
Mm-hmm. And this seems to be in the same trend of not having a clear delineation of powers between the government and the court and the police and the ministers, right? There seems to be a lack of clarity around roles. It's been seen a lot with Ben-Gvir's power struggle with the police, but obviously we're seeing it with the coalition's power struggle with the courts. So I don't want to ask you to predict anything, but what could a dialogue look like? What could a productive dialogue look like? Because there are many people who are in favor of the protests. I'll add myself to this group of people who also want to see a constitution, want to see clear roles for the courts versus the coalition, what everyone has the ability to do, which doesn't quite exist yet. So are you at all optimistic that that sort of authentic process can emerge with the opposition and with the coalition working together to build something?
No, I'm not that optimistic.
Great.
Again, we have to be clear-eyed about what's happening and what's not happening here. Again, I think this is a good problem to have, because as of 48 hours ago, we were looking at a major collision and likely a major explosion in a week or two, i.e. imminent. And so now I like to think of it, this is a, in Middle Eastern terms, this is a tahdiya, a truce, and not a hudna, which is more of a ceasefire. So it's a truce for, I guess, a month or so, a month and a half, but not really a ceasefire or longer term armistice between the government and the protest movement and the opposition. So I think we have to put this in its right context. Yes, dialogue is always better than conflict and collisions, especially if they seep down into the streets between actual citizens and or actual security forces and citizens. So it's obviously always better to sit around a table and hold talks. But we also have to be, again, clear-eyed about what the government wants and wanted by floating this entire agenda, and what the protest movement and the opposition wanted the government not to do. So the government essentially wanted to take complete control over the judicial system and the courts. I mean, there's no two ways about it. Essentially, to remove any check and balance over government decisions and Knesset legislation, essentially majoritarian rule, as listeners of this podcast know all too well and knew all too early from the various experts and officials that we've had on. We don't need to kind of rehash the implications of that. So unless Netanyahu and his fellow travelers and people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and Yariv Levin and Simcha Rotman want to change their entire stripes and are okay now with genuine reform as opposed to a complete takeover of Israel's judicial system, then maybe. But I don't really see that happening. So that's on the government side of the ledger. And then on the other side, I don't think you can have, I don't think the opposition or the protest movement will agree to half a dictatorship. And so, okay, you can have dialogue and talks about reform, but it can't end up with the government having control over the other branch of government. And so I don't know where that Venn diagram overlaps. Again, I think Yair Lapid, the opposition leader, said he would agree to have the president, Isaac Herzog, convene this dialogue and to use the proposal Herzog had put forward, I think, 2 weeks ago as a basis for discussions. I think that would be a positive development because his proposal wasn't that unreasonable. But we also have to remember that the government immediately rejected the president's proposal when he first announced it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Love the optimism from you, Neri. It's great.
Look, people don't come to Israel Policy Pod for the good news, but they come for the real talk, I like to think.
Yeah.
And so,
definitely agree.
So again, they can enter into talks. We'll see if they go anywhere. And we're, again, it's a good problem to have, but we're delaying a potential rerun of what we just saw over the past 3 months and over the past 2 days to the summer. And again, that's weeks and in some cases months away. Like you said at the top, Shani, a day in Israeli politics feels like a lifetime. So now we're talking about many days away and many lifetimes away. And a lot of things can happen between.
So when does the Knesset break until exactly? When have we been pausing this legislation until? Because I thought it was just after Passover.
So after Passover this year, we roll right into the national holidays. So Independence Day, Memorial Day, Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Memorial Day. And so you basically run until the end of April and likely the beginning of May until the Knesset's summer session begins. Mm-hmm. So it's bought us a little over a month. And I think that's nothing to sneeze at. And also we should also mention that as people who have been to Israel know very well, not a lot gets done anyway in normal times during the quote unquote holidays in Israel. And so that's true for the politics and the Knesset. That's also true just for people being away on vacation in terms of people actually protesting or people choosing to spend time with their families. So it's, you know, I think it's a good time for everybody to catch their breath.
So during this 5 or 6 week period, are people going to be in dialogue at all sort of across the aisle, or is everyone just regrouping and taking a break and then coming back together afterwards for the debates and dialogues and negotiations to happen in early May?
So I think the intention is to hold talks through the coming month. Again, I don't know, you know, everything is kind of fast moving, so we'll have to see. But first step is to make sure that Netanyahu and his coalition actually do what Netanyahu said he would do, which is not push through the legislation by Passover. So that's, I think, a week away. And I think in and of itself, that would be fairly dramatic because we've seen now since the government was formed and seated in late December, this mad push at the exclusion literally of everything else in Israel, whether economics or security or social policy or whatever you like. The one focus of this government, including the coalition and the Knesset, was this judicial overhaul legislation, really tunnel vision. And so I think in and of itself, that will be interesting to see how an individual like Simcha Rotman actually tries to spin the fact that his boss, the prime minister, basically caved. And then he essentially lent his hand to that caving. And that's up until Passover. Then the Knesset goes on recess, so you can't really get much or anything done either. So presumably you may have talks and dialogue, maybe presumably under the auspices of the president. And we'll have to wait and see how that unfolds. Look, my best guess is that both sides will use it as kind of a blame game. And Netanyahu will come out of it and saying, well, we made a genuine good faith effort to negotiate, but we didn't find a partner on the other side. If this sounds familiar to listeners from the endless rounds of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, and I don't think that's incidental. I don't think that's a coincidence, rather. And so you may see Netanyahu try to leverage these quote-unquote talks, what he said, I extended my hand in good faith, to try to peel off a lot of the more moderate elements that came out on to the streets. Some very likely even voted for Likud in the last election and said, well, I tried my best, but there was no partner on the other side. And so we're moving forward with this, basically to try to divide and conquer the protest movement, as he's done with previous protest movements. So again, have to wait and see how that entire dynamic unfolds.
Mm-hmm. I suppose it's anybody's guess if he'll be successful at that, but he does tend to have a pretty high success rate in his endeavors.
Yeah.
Until now, actually.
Yeah, but that was the old Netanyahu. That was the old Netanyahu. If anybody, so polling came out about an hour or two ago from the major TV stations, and very clearly Likud has cratered in the polls, and the opposition, by the way, including especially Benny Gantz himself, because he's attracting a lot of these kind of soft right-wing voters. Benny Gantz is surging, and writ large, the coalition that now controls 64 seats in Knesset is down, according to these polls, to 54 seats. So they've managed to lose 10 seats in 3 months, you know, in terms of being in power 3 months. That might be an Israeli record.
Yeah. And that's not just a today trend, right? A few weeks ago, we saw those polls have been consistent over the past month or so, probably.
Yeah. And I'll say two things. Number one, I don't think Bibi Netanyahu himself and his nationalist right-wing camp have been this unpopular in probably 17 years, going back arguably to the very weird election of 2006 in Israel, which if anybody wants to look up, it's the weirdest election you will ever see in Israel. It's when Netanyahu ended up with 12 seats and Ehud Olmert won handily. But yeah, Netanyahu himself has never been this unpopular. And that's through successive election campaigns, obviously in the past 5 years. So that's one thing. The second thing I'll say is that it's not just his personal popularity. It's not just his coalition. It's I think a wider sense among growing parts of the Israeli public, and again, not reflexively anti-Netanyahu, not reflexively left wing at all, that enough is enough. That this one man and the decisions he makes and the people he has around him, I won't say any more, but the people that he has around him are causing real, genuine, existential harm to the state of Israel. And that if anything fundamental will be able to change in Israel, then this man that's been in power longer than any other leader in Israeli history needs to go away. And that wasn't the case even in the last election in November, where a lot of people, again, not reflexively pro-Netanyahu, held their nose and voted Netanyahu because they viewed him as the more stable and known quantity in Israeli politics. I think that sentiment is definitely gone.
Mm-hmm. And do you think this could be a movement towards, not a new Likud, but sort of a rejuvenation of the old school Likud, which was a lot more conservative in the traditional sense of the word? A lot more pragmatic, a lot less nationalist, a lot less religious?
Yeah, I think that last point is key. I would say conservative in maybe the American conception, right? The Likud was a right-wing nationalist but liberal movement and very much not in the mold of, say, the more right-wing religious nationalist elements, which Likud is becoming more and more like. So for many Likud Knesset members and even ministers, I'd be hard-pressed to find that much difference either personally or politically between them and, say, religious Zionism and Bezalel Smotrich's party. Right. Yeah. The difference is very, very small. And in the past, that difference used to be massive, massive. And so in Likud, no, I wouldn't hold out hope for Likud. I think a lot of them are still quite scared of Bibi Netanyahu and the machine that he has behind him. led and orchestrated by his son, Yair Netanyahu. That's still a very real thing. So even, right, even after Gallant gave his very courageous speech, it has to be said, because Gallant had to know that he was essentially putting his own political career at jeopardy for the, I guess, the security and future of the country. But that was Gallant's decision to do that. Most other Likud officials chose the opposite and did not actually come out and say that, look, we need to stop this madness. Some even, I guess, anonymously maybe supported Gallant or maybe even publicly, but said, you know, they would still vote in favor of the judicial overhaul legislation if it came to a vote. So again, I wouldn't hold out hope for Likud officials to find the courage of their convictions until Netanyahu actually exits the stage. And after that, I was talking to somebody yesterday. I likened it to Palestinian politics. So Likud politics, very similar to Palestinian politics, where the pool of successors to Bibi Netanyahu, like the pool of successors to Abu Mazen, is both way too large and way too shallow. Way too large and way too shallow. That all of them see themselves as the natural successor, as Likud leader to Bibi. But none of them really have the gravitas and the charisma, and so they'll probably just end up fighting themselves and maybe actually just destroying the movement.
I don't want to draw too many comparisons between that and successors for another leader that's been in power for too long. But
we could do a whole podcast, Shani, about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and this essentially this Israeli spring or Israeli intifada that we've seen now over the past 3 months, down to the vocabulary used, down to a lot of the same techniques used, whether, you know, resistance and kind of protest and general strikes. There are a lot of similarities. And by the way, they're both protesting against the kind of most reactionary, extremist and religious and far right religious elements in Israeli politics too. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a coincidence either.
Yes, I've actually been receiving messages from a lot of friends from the Arab world, particularly Palestinians, asking me if this, or really telling me that, oh, this is the Arab Spring in Israel. I was like, oh God, don't say that. I don't know if that's what we want, but it's definitely interesting to draw the lines between them.
Yeah, considering the how the Arab Spring ended up in many Middle Eastern countries, yes. By the way, there was an Israeli Spring when the Arab Spring was going on, and that was the social justice protest movement in 2011. Which I think in and of itself was the largest protest movement to date then in Israeli history. And Netanyahu, like you alluded to, did a very good job of kind of dividing and conquering and basically just dragged on promises of real negotiations with the protest movement, and then eventually kind of dissipated. It all dissipated, and Netanyahu lived to fight another day. This time, I think people on the other side, I mean, in terms of the protester leaders and the opposition, I think are a bit smarter and are drawing the right lessons from the experience of 2011, which in and of itself was quite like we've seen now in Israel, quite uplifting, a lot of promise. But the ask, the lift in 2011 was a lot harder than it is now. The stakes were lower back in 2011, but the in terms of kind of just the cost of living and housing prices and the cost of cottage cheese and all that. So the stakes were lower, but the ask was much higher, which is essentially to reorient the entire Israeli economy and to do it quickly in order to get a grip on the high cost of living in Israel. So that was back in 2011. This time you had the stakes were much higher, essentially existential in terms of the future of Israeli democracy, but the ask was a lot less, essentially stop. And so Netanyahu did, as of today, at least for a little while.
I know you've been covering these protests, obviously, very in person, right? You've been showing up to them. So can you share what that's been like and sort of where the line is? Because you're obviously a journalist and you're going to cover things, but these are really passionate issues that you also feel connected to, I'm sure. So what has covering that been like? What are you seeing? If you want to really paint a clear picture for our listeners about it.
Yeah, it's a great question. So first of all, it's been exhausting. So it's felt, and I'm not the only one in terms of journalists, and especially foreign journalists, to say this, but it's almost like covering a war in Israel, in terms of just the fast pace, the level, the tempo of events, just the focus needed over a period of time. But this war had gone on for 3 months, or still going on, quote unquote war. Or maybe not quote unquote war. So really, ever since, I guess, early January, it's been essentially 6-7 days a week, especially with demonstrations every Saturday night. So you go to that. I live in Tel Aviv, so there really is no excuse. And it is important to see things for yourself. So I go as a journalist, and that's, I think, a very important distinction to draw. I'm there to cover and to see things for myself, and there really is no substitute for that. To see the types of people that come out, the different demographics, and it had been interesting to see that earlier on it was maybe a slightly older demographic. A lot of the usual kind of suspect, especially in central Tel Aviv. But more and more, the demonstrations became younger, and more young people came out. And that was interesting just to see for myself. Also, the handmade signs, the effective lack of organization during a lot of these mass demonstrations. There's no one really orchestrating it. They'll set up a stage and a sound system, but it doesn't really reach the full extent of the protest. And so people in the farther reaches of the protest, down Kaplan Street or farther down the Azrieli Junction, for those who know this area, they're kind of just doing their own thing. So it's basically this big street carnival and a protest and people just there looking around. And it is very, very uplifting. And I've had Israelis constantly say, this was a very, very difficult and dark time for the country, politically, socially, even psychologically. And again, this has been going on now for 3 months. And so the one silver lining is that they came out and saw like-minded Israelis, by the way, from all gamuts, all facets of Israeli society. So it's not just the usual suspects and left-wingers in Tel Aviv coming out and protesting. It's people who have never protested a day in their lives. Never protested a day in their lives, and some who identify as right wing. But they came out and they saw all these like-minded Israelis, really the best that the country has to offer. Like we said, from the tech sector and reservists and who never really protested before, not in this way for kind of a political reason, and lawyers and doctors and all down the line, everybody. And so that gave people a lot of comfort that there was a shared sense of solidarity to stop the government from pushing through its destructive agenda. So in terms of just covering it, yes, it was difficult, tiring, but also uplifting. And you kind of, you know, there's a kind of a cadence or a tempo to it. You go and you check out certain aspects of it, and you kind of assess how many people actually showed up, whether the momentum was staying the same or growing or lessening. That's also important to see. You go and you spend time with the protesters who tried to shut down the main highway, the Ayalon Highway. So you're there kind of seeing how the police handle the protesters and how the protesters are handling the police, which again, wasn't a given that this would be so moderate and so nonviolent, by the way, from both sides, the police vis-a-vis the protesters and the protesters vis-a-vis the police. And there was a kind of a whole choreography to it. But in Israeli terms, very, very soft gloves were used on the protesters. And I say this as somebody who's covered, demonstrations all across Israel and the West Bank. So I've seen demonstrations by Palestinians in the West Bank, by Palestinians in East Jerusalem, by Haredis in Jerusalem, by Arab Israelis in the South and the North, and by Ethiopian Israelis in Tel Aviv. And I can tell you, yes, a lot of force can and often is used by the Israeli police and the security forces. Mm-hmm. And so it was a good thing that this wasn't the case over the past 3 months. And yeah, it's just a major story, to be covering. And just, I'll say one final point on this, Shani, covering it as a foreign journalist based in Tel Aviv and based in Israel, it wasn't a natural story for the foreign media and the international press to begin with. That the coverage usually focuses on issues of war and peace, issues of Israeli-Palestinian violence, and sometimes diplomacy, but usually violence, elections. And so it took a while for the foreign media to actually appreciate the significance of what was happening in Israel and the stakes involved. And so at a certain point, maybe a few weeks in, it was understood, the gravity of the situation was understood. And so you saw this kind of this tidal wave of interest and demand about what was happening in Israel on what is effectively a domestic issue, which is usually of less interest to the world. But I think really just see the level of attention over this past weekend and the last couple of days. I think the entire world now understands why this protest movement was so important and why what the government under Bibi Netanyahu was trying to do was so dangerous. And I think that's also important to realize and understand in the context of the past 3 months.
Just picking up on your note, comparing this protest to previous protests in which the protesters were Arabs, ultra-Orthodox, Ethiopians, the comparison in saying that the police were more violent in those protests, as an American hearing it, honestly just sounds like it's racism and classism. Is that what you believe it was? Or do you think that there's more to it and that perhaps the police resonate more with the cause today than they did with those causes? Or is it just these people maybe look like me, or these people are whiter, more liberal, more secular, living in Tel Aviv, and therefore I know that it's a worse look to be violent against them?
So it's a great question. I think, by the way, we should mention the protests were not just in Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv was the biggest protest on a weekly basis, but it was all over the country. So we shouldn't just, we can't just explain this away as kind of liberal Tel Avivis protesting.
Let me interrupt to ask, were the highways blocked in those other cities? Because that's where I feel like the friction gets worse, because the highways are blocked and now that's when the police really need to step in. Did that happen elsewhere?
It happened, I mean, some road closures in Jerusalem, but no, nothing to the extent of the Ayalon Highway, the battle for the Ayalon Highway, which became this symbol. Basically, how can we break through the police lines and barriers and get to the Ayalon? This was, for a while, it seemed like the be-all and end-all to the protest. But again, there was a kind of a rationale to that, you know, essentially disrupting life and forcing the police to engage, and having those images broadcast to the wider country was important. But to answer your original question, which again, it's a very good one. I think it's all of those elements, right? That when the Israel police are deployed to tackle, say, more mainstream Israelis, they look at them and they see people who they might have served in various military units with, or people who they might have studied with, or people who they know from back home. And I heard this verbatim from one or two police officers. And so that in and of itself is helpful. Number two, without doubt, how Arab Israelis and definitely Palestinians, whether in East Jerusalem or the West Bank, are dealt with and handled and are engaged with, is vastly different than how the Israel police engages with Israeli Jews in terms of law enforcement inside Israel. So again, we have to be very clear about that. And then number three, and this is, I guess, more to the credit of the Israel police, they use a level of force that they feel is necessary given the level of threat that they perceive to them. Right.
Yeah.
So they won't use this kind of a scale of the level of quote unquote nonviolent means that they use against demonstrators and rioters. And the protesters on their part were very, very clear from the very beginning up till literally today that violence should not be directed at the police.
Yeah.
Because again, from the protesters' point of view, these are our brothers as well. And this is a chance that they were saying the police are our brothers too. We're here for you too. These were chants by the protesters. And also, I heard this chanted verbatim by the protesters: we're not going to give Ben-Gvir and the government this picture.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to let we're not going to engage and escalate violently with the police because we don't want to have Bibi Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir and the others come out immediately and say, oh, we told you these guys are anarchists and that they're seditionists and traitors. You shouldn't take them seriously. You shouldn't join their cause. And so there was a very clear strategic rationale by the protesters to keep it nonviolent. And the police, except for one exception, one Wednesday demonstration in Tel Aviv where they deployed stun grenades, other than that bad day in Tel Aviv, again, relatively bad for Tel Aviv relative to other demonstrations anywhere else in Israel, very, very kind of mild stuff. But other than that day, the police reciprocated as well.
Mm-hmm. My last question for you is something that my spouse asked me yesterday, and I'm curious if your answer was the same as mine. He's not really tuned into Israel things, but he does have a Twitter. So, of course, he was aware of the situation.
My condolences.
usually it's just filled with basketball, but today it was also filled with Israel.
Smart.
And so he asked me if I think that what's happening right now over the past few months is going to make it into Israeli history books in 50 years. And I said yes. I said a resounding yes, but I'm curious what you think, being more on the ground than I am.
Yeah, 100%. Without doubt, this is a seminal moment in Israeli history. A hinge moment, you could say, but we also don't know how things will play out in the coming months, as we talked about earlier. So it's still, the story is still in process. But without doubt, this was a seminal moment in Israeli history. Again, coming on the eve of Israel's 75th birthday. So there is some appropriate symmetry there. And it was a seminal moment, I think, in terms of what the government under Netanyahu was threatening to do, which is essentially undermine the entire democratic foundation of the state. And also the pushback that they received by the vast majority, hundreds of thousands of Israelis, who really put everything on hold and pushed back. And if we're getting into the kind of decision-making psychology of Bibi Netanyahu, how he got himself into this position where today he had to address the nation and give a pretty ridiculous and humiliating speech, talking about the judgment of Solomon and all of that, going back 3,000 years, but that's a different issue. Netanyahu, I think, wagered on the fact when he won the election and then formed this government and then allowed his justice minister to float this bombastic plan to undermine the judicial system here in early January, that, yeah, there might be maybe some protesters in Tel Aviv and there may be some criticism domestically and maybe in some various foreign capitals, but that really he could weather any storm and then it would just be a speed bump on the way and they'd be able to push all of this through like they planned before Passover. And that he didn't count on the vast Israeli middle, liberal Israel. But again, I saw this in the protests too, religious Israelis too. So maybe not that liberal Israel, but the vast Israeli middle, both left and right, came out to tell him no, finally. And I think that in and of itself is historic, just given Israeli political history over the past two or three decades.
Sure. And I'm feeling optimistic. So I will just note that I think that there is a chance that at year 75, Israel can finally start to move closer towards some sort of constitution with enshrined rights, clear delineation of powers. And maybe the moment we're seeing is just kind of that terrible moment right before something really positive emerges.
Yeah. It's always darkest before dawn. But I think yes, you need to be optimistic, but I think we all need to take this Passover holiday break, whether you're in Israel or outside of Israel and watching Israel, to take a breather and to look at what may be coming ahead, because we're not out of it yet. Not out of it yet, but this was a huge victory under very difficult circumstances and under a very tight timeline. And so that is in and of itself a reason for optimism. And, the Israel policy pod is nothing if not optimistic always. So we should take that to our center tables.
Beautiful. I thought no one comes here for the optimism.
Yeah, that's tongue in cheek. But today was a win. today was a win, and that's important in and of itself.
Thank you so much, Nery.
It's my pleasure, Shani. And what people need to know about interviewing and podcasting in particular is that it's a lot harder to be the host than it is to be the guest. The guest may kind of speak a lot more, but the host actually has to think intentionally about the questions and the direction of the interview and the structuring of the interview. So I think you did a fantastic job.
Thank you so much, Nery. This has been great. Well, have a wonderful holiday season. I guess for Israel, this is the holiday season. So have a great holiday season, everybody.
You too, Shani. Bye.
Okay. Thank you again, Nery Zilber. Also, a special thanks to our producer, Jacob Gilman, and to all those of you who support Israel Policy Forum's work, including this podcast. You know who you are. Just remember to subscribe. And in the spirit of the Israeli holiday season, please leave a 5-star review if you enjoy this podcast. Thank you for listening.